Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening, listeners. This is Lynn at Century Health Talk, and with me tonight is Andy. Hey, Andy, how are you doing today?
We're doing great.
That's great. We were having some technical difficulties, and I think we may have averted bad ones. What do you think, Andy?
I think we're doing a lot better now. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you with my phone. You need to have a different phone. Yours is crackly. I could hardly hear you.
Well, it is not exactly the best phone in the world. It's not a smartphone by any stretch of the imagination.
Oh, you have a dumb phone? Is that what you're saying?
I have a not-so-smartphone. Let's not be negative about technology.
So tonight, our topic is the power of storytelling. Who doesn't like listening to stories? Okay, I didn't hear anybody, so I guess everybody likes listening to stories.
I like listening to stories.
Oh, so do I. Heck, you know, even in school, when I was in school, that was a long time ago, you know, my teacher, especially my physics teacher, he would capture our attention by telling stories. And I can remember some of the stories that he told me. I don't necessarily remember how it worked in the lecture, but I remember certain things. So that's another thing. Storytelling is very powerful. It's because you remember things better.
Absolutely. I find storytelling to be a very important concept and idea in today's culture. I mean, we live in the connectivity age. People are always sharing information, and I feel that storytelling is one more avenue for us to live more life. I mean, if somebody's telling a good story, especially if it is a factual story, I believe that, you know, an individual is enriched by that experience. So it's not always, you don't always have to get information or stories from static devices like books or television. There is something to be said about, you know, the being able to hear a story, being able to pick up on their micro expressions from somebody who is right in front of your face. I think that type of interaction is kind of, I don't want to say it's gone in decline, it's just a little bit harder to find these days.
Good storytellers, yeah, definitely. But before we continue on that trend, definitely let's chat a little bit, because we haven't been on air for, 4 weeks. That's kind of so we need to catch up and let everybody know what has been happening in the past month. So what have you been doing in the past 4 weeks, Andy?
Well, let's see here. Musically, I've been getting ready to release a new extended play, I don't want to say album, but an extended play single, basically. It's going to have 5 songs of some of my latest material that I've been sketching out on. It's going to be a little bit more moody, a little bit more soundtracky. I am opening up with a little bit of a dance track, but it kind of hits you kind of hard. It's a little dancey for the first couple of tracks, and then it kind of winds down into something a little bit more moody, a little bit more I don't say down tempo, but I mean, there's a lot of emotional content still there. The EP is slated for release. I'm going to try to get it out by late May on my Bandcamp.
Okay. Well, hopefully before I leave for Alaska, so I can bring it with me, you know, because I am driving. I need music.
Oh, you know, I'll probably have, like, you know, the A.R. Mayer, you know, collection, you know, grand collection released here shortly. I'll bring you a CD.
Okay, good. That's great. Because, yeah, there are times in which, you know, long driving and so on and so forth, you get mostly just, oh, country music. And I'm not really much a fan of country music. There's some country music I can listen to, but there's, I just can't do an hour's worth of it. Heck, I can't, I don't think I can do like 3 songs in a row of it.
I could do like maybe 10 minutes.
That's about three songs in a row.
Right, and it depends. If it's a country power ballad, then maybe you're getting a song and a half.
Oh. Well, there are some songs I do like from Rascal Flatts, definitely.
I think country music makes the best breakup music ever.
Okay, it could be, yes. It could be a breakup song, but there's some good songs, actually, that has good lyrics, and I like them. I can't name from the top of my head as far as who they were, but there's some good ones, actually. It's poetic. I love it. But I just can't stand more than 3 songs in a row of it.
So it's a little bit more, for me, it's the guitar twang.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
me too.
It's kind of funny, because there's a lot of country rock that I actually enjoy, like Montgomery Gentry and Candyland.
Oh, okay.
I think those are...
Okay.
But it's country rock that I enjoy. I can't really do country western.
No, I can't do country western either. No. I can do some ballads, and it depends also the twang of how they sing. There's a twangy thing at the end, and it's almost like yodeling to me.
Almost. But no, I completely hear you. It's kind of interesting because a lot of the... despite what a lot of people will admit to, there's actually a lot of context with country music and R&B soul because they kind of were developed in the same area.
Ah, mm-hmm.
Well, so I can't remember. There was a documentary where they had a bunch of country singers sing a bunch of R&B songs, and they had a bunch of R&B singers do some country songs, and they actually were able to pull it off. Now, the one thing
there's some songs that actually, but done by a couple of boy bands, All for One or whatever they're called.
I swear,
and so that actually was a country music that they turned into a love ballad.
Right. I can't. There are a couple of other songs too that started out, you know, on the pop side, and then they became country songs. And there were a couple of country songs that started on the country side, and then eventually they became pop songs again. I can't. There's a song that I Can't Make You Love Me, and I think it was covered. I think it was originally by Bonnie Raitt. I can't remember. I think it was done by Bonnie Raitt. You'll have to look it up.
Well, we'll definitely do that. So you've just been working on your CD that's coming up, hopefully going out the end of this coming month?
Actually, the end of May. So I plan to kind of release
May,
it.
Coming month.
Well, yeah, I thought you were talking about April, but yeah, it's. I plan to slate it for May. We'll see what happens, and with my other stuff, I've been taking a couple of radio classes over at Bellevue College, and getting back into DJing as well. So I've been pretty busy as of late.
Okay. Well, as for me,
You, Lynn? What have you been up to?
Oh, about 5 feet. No more than that. My shoes on 5 feet. Yeah. Yeah, I should have the rim shot, but, you know, I'm never, you know, ready, there it is, ready for that, because I just feel like I should say a joke or whatever, pun. Let's see, the first one that we missed is because I was driving up from my 2-week vacation in California. I went all the way to San Diego and back driving. This year seems to be a driving vacation kind of deal for me. So on the way down, to make my trip more, I don't know, memorable. I don't know what you're doing in there, but I can hear it. I visited friends in Eugene, Oregon, and one in, where did I go? somewhere in California near San Francisco.
Well, weren't you in the San Francisco Bay Area for a while too?
Kind of. Forgot the name of that place, but it's closer to San Francisco, I think. And then went straight to San Diego from there, and then visited family that I didn't know that lived in San Diego. I have a cousin and my niece living there. And then,
You know what's really funny about that is I've got family in San Diego, too.
Oh, do you? Well, see, I didn't know
my
cousin came back.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because, you know, it's kind of strange because you never know in the Filipino-American community whether or not you're related.
No, this one I know we're related because my niece is my sister's daughter. And my cousin was my first cousin, and I grew up with her. So we had to catch up and tell some jokes and well, kind of jokes. But she kept pulling my hair. She's that kind of a person. It's like, oh, I like your long hair. And she just kept pulling. I'm like, okay, you can stop now. You can stop now. That's my family. And then on the way back, I visited a friend in Hollywood, West Hollywood, and then went back to Eugene, Oregon, and then went home. So that was basically my trip. And then, of course, the next one that we miss is because, well, it was too close to tax time. So I decided not to do the radio show because my taxes were a lot more important to get out.
Absolutely, totally, you know, that's really responsible of you, and I think that's awesome that, you know, there's time for podcasting, but, you know, when the IRS, you know, sets, you know, it's a timeline for you to get your stuff in, it's usually a good idea to follow that timeline.
Yeah, well, you know, I'd rather not have a podcast than to have, say, a couple hundred dollars of late fees or whatever it is that they called. So, yeah, I didn't want that because I want to keep my money as much as possible. I earned that. So, it's like, no more. So basically that was it. And then now I'm planning on the trip. The next one is a driving trip to Alaska, and I'm going to be driving up there and driving back down, hopefully with my...
Oh, you're leaving us again?
Yes. Wait a minute. You know this, but then again, you pretend you don't know that. Andy works here at the office. So he helps with the administration, and hopefully by the time I leave, he'll be like a mini-me. No, actually, I'm smaller than you, so I can't be a mini-me.
I was about to say, are you trying to say I'm fat now? Huh?
I didn't say. I was... Okay, never mind. I'm going to get myself into trouble if I keep going. So basically, I guess that's what's been happening in the past months. And I might as well use this to plug. Hey, guys, we are actually growing here in the office, and I'm doing my best to branch out and do some teaching. And that's basically what I'm going to be doing in Alaska, is to start teaching Alaskans, some of them, massage cupping and some pair stretching techniques and so on and so forth, because I'm really into the sports massage / Thai massage type of techniques. So that's where I'm going to be debuting some of my seminars, classes, whatever have you. So Aaron's going to be by himself here. We do need another massage therapist, hopefully, to take on some of our cash clients, or self-pay is what we call them. So if you are interested, give us a call here at the office. It's 425-228-5217. I know it's a shameless plug, but we are growing, and I am going to be gone for a month and a half, and we do need help. 425-228-5217. So how's that, Andy?
I'm very happy as the admin to promote and plug Century Massage, because I'll tell you what, there are some massage places that, you know, I don't want to mention, that, you know, all they do is they just process you. I mean, they put you on the table, you know, they go through their stuff, and there's little or no empathy that really goes into it. I mean, I feel like I'm in a factory. But having gone to some of the smaller clinics where you have a massage therapist who has several years of experience, I mean, I'm a martial artist. I've been in a couple of car accidents. So my back is all shades of messed up. And so when I go to these kind of, I don't know, in the hairstyling industry, we call them hack and wax. I don't know what you would call them, but these places that are just, they just process you. They just, you know, throw you on the table. They, you know, they throw together a bunch of techniques and they hope that they'll heal you. And it turns out that they really don't. I mean, sure, it feels comforting while you're in the office, but you end up having to show up more often. At least with some of the smaller clinics that I've experienced, they don't want to see you on a regular basis, because if they see you on a regular basis, that means that they haven't done a good job. So,
well,
I mean, I
well,
really have to recommend.
That's
I really
I
have to recommend supporting local
yeah.
clinics.
Yep. But, you know, it also goes to the responsibility also of the client to ask questions. Don't just assume that just because they are a licensed massage practitioner, or they say they're a licensed massage practitioner, that they are.
Absolutely,
so,
do your homework.
Yeah, definitely. As a consumer, it is within your, I don't know, right to actually ask around and find out how long they've been doing the massage, what type of techniques are they doing, you know, and what to expect in a session, and then kind of talk to them as far as what your needs are. Say you may need help getting on and off the table because you have a bad back, and what will they do, and will they explain to you before you get on the table what is going to be expected, and so on and so forth. And that's basically what we do here, is we also interview a potential client. If they call in and say, I want a massage, and my first question is, what's going on? So I want to make sure that I can help them. If I can't, I don't feel that I can, then I will have to point them someplace else that I might help them, or just say, I'm sorry, but that's not what we do here.
Right. And, you know, I have heard in the industry that a lot of people are confused on, you know, the difference between an emergency room and a massage clinic.
No way.
Yeah, sometimes I've heard in the industry that, you know, people will call massage clinics expecting to receive emergency care as opposed to actually going into the emergency room and getting the care they need.
Mm-mm, no. Unfortunately, maybe that's another pun picture or photo to do, you know, somebody coming in with some emergency and we're going, we're not doctors.
Yeah, exactly. If I've heard correctly, you're not allowed to diagnose.
No, we're not doctors. We don't have that right to diagnose anybody. If they are coming in for a medical massage that is, you know, had been diagnosed by a doctor, we need that referral from the doctor in order for us to bill the insurance. And even though that some insurance says, oh, you don't need a referral, I'm sorry, but our form asks for a diagnosis. Without that referral or the prescription with the diagnosis codes or whatever it is that diagnosed, we can find the codes in our book, but it's us basically just writing down by their word or what we think, and that's actually diagnosing. We're going beyond our scope of practice, so we can get ourselves into trouble. So what we need from people initially, even though the insurance says we don't need a referral, we say, but we do, at least initially, so that we know exactly what's going on, because we can't diagnose. That's the problem.
So, public service announcement. If you are getting a medical massage and you'd like your insurance to cover it, get a prescription from your doctor.
Preferably, yes. So, yeah.
Preferably your main doctor, too.
It could be the main doctor, but sometimes a chiropractor will if they have a chiropractor and a medical doctor, and the chiropractor are most apt to refer them to massage because they're more of an alternative, health service compared to doctors. Doctors, most medical doctors, as far as I know, is well versed in how chemicals or prescriptions deal with the body and so on and so forth, and they go through lab testing and whatever, and they usually prescribe something for you or shoot you up with some anti-inflammatory or something. But there are some doctors who are really getting some education in alternative healthcare that they know exactly what massage does, and they send them to massage therapists rather than giving them, you know, muscle relaxers just because their muscle hurts. So
one way or the other, you know, this alternative medicine, especially with sports therapy, sports massage therapy, can help. It can be a viable solution to healing.
It can, but we can't, you know, promise them anything. That's the thing that we don't do, is we don't promise that we can help. I mean, we are we are able to help, but not necessarily as quickly as you think, or the way, you know, you think you're going to be 100%. We can never make guarantees, but we can try. We can do some stuff, and usually within the first 3 sessions, you will notice some differences, hopefully a positive difference. So, hey, you want to know 20 unusual uses for coffee?
Sure, because I could always use a cup of coffee.
Oh, I don't know about this one, if you want to use it after it's been used in these manner. But, but there are
more ways. So tell me about the 20 uses for coffee.
But, you know, there are now more ways to justify your addiction to coffee, you know? I mean, a lot of people cannot imagine life without coffee because without coffee, they're actually not human. That's what I've heard.
You don't drink coffee, Lynn?
No, I do drink coffee, but it has a different effect on me. It doesn't necessarily wake me up. It actually makes me nervous for about half an hour if it's strong enough, and then I just crash. I want to go to sleep. It just does the opposite. So I can drink coffee at night.
Wow. That's... Yeah. I don't know if that's a perk or not, you know. Maybe it is a perk, maybe it's not.
No, I don't like the nervous feeling, though. That's the thing. And when I get nervous after a strong coffee, that's when I have to be careful if I'm, you know, driving, because it's not going to keep me up. It just makes me go to the bathroom often, but at the same time, it just makes me sleepy, tired.
Interesting.
It's
so
a high and a
crash. Your certificate's for you.
My favorite is toffee nut latte, so it's more milk than coffee. So here's one. It says here it kills fridge odor. So see, you don't want to use it after it's been used. So it says basically, wouldn't you rather smell coffee than a 2-week-old leftover, half-rotten produce and spoiled milk? So basically, a lot of people have been using it instead of using, like, baking soda.
So if you're in college and you're living off of root beer and pizza, and you forgot to put the date when you bought the pizza, and it's going to have its own mold colony, use coffee, you know, throw out the pizza, obviously, but put in, like, do I want to put in, like, a fresh mug of coffee or, you know, like, a lukewarm thing of coffee? Just in like a cup or something?
Yeah, well, that's what they're saying. And here's a second one. It reduces cellulite. Apparently, people are using it as a major ingredient in some cellulite cream. for some reason, they say it supposedly enhances fat metabolism and reduces the appearance of fatty pockets under the skin. And some people are actually making their own coffee cellulite treatment at home by mixing warm used coffee grounds. Hey, at least it's recyclable. With some coconut oil and rub it on the skin in a circular motion for, you know, a couple of minutes before rinsing. So if we had a, you know, access to a shower, we could possibly use it and ask people to send in, you know, some coffee grounds or something.
That's, wow. Because I know there would be an entire line of, I can just see the marketing possibilities at this point, especially living here in the Northwest, where, I mean, there's like a latte on every, you know, like a latte stand on every corner and everything. I mean, I'm kind of thinking about this, and I'm thinking, well, wouldn't you also get a buzz from that? I mean, I don't know if
it
you would
could.
Or not, but I mean.
I guess maybe it could, but if it's used, most of the caffeine is probably steamed out of there.
True.
I mean, I've heard of other ways for it, but I'll see if it's on this list before I comment and bring that up. So the third one that I have here is very similar to the first one, the killing of the odors. It says it erases smells on your hands. So I guess, you know, rubbing a handful of, again, used coffee grounds. Guys, don't throw away your coffee grounds. Use it again to get rid of, like, garlic, salmon, cilantro smells on your hands, especially if you are the cook or something and don't want to have people, you know, smelling your hand if it's fishy or whatever. Yep, erase the smell on your hands.
So this is primarily for the use of the coffee grounds after you've brewed a fresh cup of coffee.
Yes, but the first one is actually a can of coffee grounds, not used. It's unused.
Oh, okay.
The first one is unused, and everything else after that has been used coffee grounds.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. And this one I knew, that used coffee grounds can actually be used in compost. And a lot of gardeners are swearing by it because it has, you know, coffee grounds are rich with in phosphorus, potassium, magnesium, and copper, and they release nitrogen into the soil as they start degrading. And, you know, and there's, since they're a little bit acidic, which is actually great for some certain soils. So, yeah, if you compost on a large scale, you definitely need to use a lot of coffee grounds. And you can get them probably free from your local coffee hotspots or a mom-and-pop cafe or something.
That's really interesting. I wonder if I could go down to, like, my local PCC and ask them, hey, could I get some of your used coffee grounds for my garden? I think that'd be great.
Yeah, definitely. And the next one, get this. Some people are actually using it to get shiny hair. And I don't know. I've never heard of it, but it says that coffee is often used or often recommended as a simple natural treatment to make hair extra glossy. So basically what you do is you brew up an extra strong pot and let it cool and apply it to your dry hair, the dry clean hair, and then leave it on for at least maybe 20 minutes, then rinse, and then keep it up for about a week or so for best result. I don't necessarily want to smell like coffee, though.
Well, there's some people who really enjoy the smell of coffee, so that might be a plus for them, you know.
Hmm.
I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, being in, you know, in an office where you're getting the smell, you know, it's morning and, you know, you've got the smell of coffee in the office, and then for whatever reason, you know, the secretaries are having a meeting in a room and they're treating their hair with coffee. I mean, that's a bit of a whammy. That's pretty hardcore.
Well, preferably you do this at home and not at the office.
Well, okay, yeah, true.
Okay, and the next one, it says it's a natural dye. There's natural pigments in the coffee that makes it a great natural dye for fabrics, paper, Easter eggs. Or, as they say, even your hair. But I'm not quite sure if even doing it in your hair with a natural dye, shouldn't the next shower take it all out?
I wouldn't know. I mean, I've got some white hair right now and stuff because I'm getting up there in my years. I'm just wondering, how would that brown coffee kind of look against my, you know, my dark raven hair? You know,
well, I can see maybe using coffee, the natural pigments, you know, with water, look like a brown watercolor.
Yeah.
Yeah. reading through here, it says the result won't be color fast. It may bleed out onto other items. So I guess, yeah, you just a day's worth of brown hair, and that's it. If it rains, you're done for.
Right.
So, the next one is it reduces fireplace mess. So basically, you have to wait until the embers are cool. Sprinkle damp coffee grounds all over the ashes. Let them sit for about 15 minutes and then scoop out the whole mess into a metal ash can. The coffee grounds cling to the ashes so they don't spew dust nearly as much as they would otherwise. Ah. Okay. That's a good
there
idea.
Go.
But I don't have a fireplace to have that happen. Okay, next, pincushion filler, dried used coffee grounds. Hopefully, yeah, I guess they have to be really dry. Are used to as a perfect filler for homemade pincushions. And you just wrap around a scrap of cloth, tie it off with a rubber band or place a cloth or, you know, in an egg cup, other small container, and the grounds will keep your pins from rusting, too. Didn't know that.
Interesting.
It's probably because it doesn't have a lot of oxidation.
That's really useful, come to think about it, you know.
Okay.
So you can use it as a rust preventative?
Yeah, I guess so. Interesting.
Huh.
Well, the next one is kind of related to the reducing cellulite, I think, because they're saying you can use the coffee grounds to exfoliate the skin. So the same properties that reportedly enable coffee to reduce the appearance of cellulite can smooth and tighten your skin and the texture of the ground of the coffee. Of the ground coffee will buff away any dead skin cells. I mean, that's basically what massage does too. We also, you know, the rubbing and all that stuff can rub off some of the dead skin. So it can exfoliate, but not as much as coffee grounds can. And it, I guess it says a drop of your favorite essential oil would probably make it even better. But coffee smell with peppermint,
I think that's a great smell, actually. I love coffee and I love the smell of peppermint. Yeah, that's Christmas to me, honestly.
Eggnog is Christmas to me. Okay. Here's another one. You got ants running around in your house? Apparently, it repels ants. All you do is sprinkle dry used coffee grounds in problem areas where you notice ants in your home or yard, and they just might pick up and leave. That's interesting.
Well, there you go. Ants are the anti-hipsters.
The next one on the list is basically very closely related to the compost thing because it says it fertilizes plants because of acid-loving plants likes this stuff. If you sprinkle your used coffee grounds around the roots, so it can serve as a fertilizer as well. And it also, the next one is related to the garden. It keeps cats out of the gardens. I guess they don't like the smell of coffee.
I guess cats are also the anti-hipsters.
Well, apparently because of the smell of it. I guess the smell of it or something like that. It's just sprinkling used coffee grounds on the soil, and the cats will want nothing to do with it. So they don't use, the area, you know, because what is it that they use it usually as a litter box sometimes?
Oh, okay.
sand or soil, you know, they use it as a litter box. So with some coffee in there, it just kind of repels them for some reason. I have no idea. They didn't say why, but seemingly every cat in a 5-mile radius, you know, kind of loves to go in a vegetable garden and use it as a cat litter. But for some reason, I don't know if it's the smell of the coffee that they don't like. So, oh, and you can use coffee to scrub all kinds of surfaces. It's a mildly abrasive and acidic that it's great for scrubbing surfaces like countertops, cooking ranges, and refrigerators. So just mix it up with a little bit of soap dish and you're good to go.
Awesome.
Oh, an auto air freshener. Who wants to? If you can't drink it, you know, driving and falling asleep, I guess maybe that'll help you wake up. Maybe it'll help me wake up. No, wait, it puts me to sleep, drinking. So maybe, I don't know, maybe smelling is different.
So right now, I think we've got a caller on the line right now. And I
do we?
To this individual via email. So I think he kind of wants to talk about, you know, maybe if he's got any input on this. So let's see here. Do I just hit the mute?
Yeah,
the
microphone button. We're trying to train Andy here.
Andy!
Did you hit the microphone button? Let me do that.
Here
we go, 360. You're on the air. How are you? And what's your name, by the way?
Good evening. My name is Kelvin.
Kelvin, hey. Thank you for calling. We were just talking about the 20 uses, which we never got to the 20th, uses of coffee. So looking at the time, hey, we should start talking about storytelling.
That's what I'm here for.
Yay, Kelvin, thank you for calling. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Bellingham, up north.
Oh,
on the Canadian border on the west coast, yeah.
I'll be passing through there in about a month.
Right. It's a beautiful place.
To drive through and get back to Alaska for a visit. So that's going to be a long drive.
You know, it's really funny. I've got family in Alaska, too.
So anyway, we were the topic for discussion tonight is the power of storytelling. And when I was going through the internet as far as to talk about storytelling, it seems to be everywhere. And nobody thinks anything of it, but it's everywhere. When you talk to somebody, you just can't say, do this. You have to kind of give them a story why you want them to do that. So that's a part of the storytelling. But some storytelling are more elaborate as far as it has to be a hero and a goal. And then there's some, they do a storytelling in using each word of each letter of the word to represent another item that they're trying to remember.
Right, right. So, well, I'm a professional storyteller in Bellingham of doing traditional storytelling. I'm familiar with the stand up in front of an audience and lay the story out. Not memorized, but in an improvisational style. But I know storytellers across the country who do a wide range of storytelling. And I agree, it seems to be seeing a renaissance now. We're seeing lots of new tellers coming on, lots more interest in audiences. It's great.
And most of the professional storytellers, they actually use their whole body to tell the stories and their facial expressions and all that stuff, and that's what captures the audience.
Mostly, yes. Some of them, though, I have seen some who stand fairly still. You might see a lot more expression in their eyes and their face, but they're not moving around on the stage. They're not waving their arms around. I tend to be a lot more physical and a lot more movement-centered. And then you go all the way to the other range. There's a couple of storytellers out of San Francisco who form a group called Ethnotech, who are very theatrical. So they memorize their stories because they tell it in tandem together. And every move is choreographed, and every word and pacing is choreographed. So there's a very wide range, all the way from, you know, sitting in a small group and telling very subtly with very small changes in your voice tone, all the way to theatrical storytelling, which is really covering a whole stage and a wide range of movements and levels and very precise choreographed performances.
What would you call, what would be the difference between the type of telling that you do? Because I've done a little bit of research on the Bellingham Storytellers Guild. What is the difference between the oral traditional storytelling that I have seen and heard about and dramatic interpretation, or are they one and the same thing?
They're very close. I think it really depends on what you're trying to do. In general, I think that the best description I've ever run across pinning the difference between anything that's theater-centered or dramatic-centered and what's generally known as storytelling, to my mind, was the person said, well, storytelling happens with the lights on. And that sounds rather simple, but really that's the core of it, is more traditional storytelling, oral storytelling tradition. You generally do have a situation where you're in front of or surrounded by an audience, where the audience can see you very well, you can see the audience very well, and you make an effort to focus your relationship that you're building during the story with people in the audience. Oftentimes, theatrical storytelling, dramatic interpretation, is done in a more formal theater-style atmosphere. The house lights are up. The performer can't see anybody in the audience. And they're playing to the space rather than telling the story to an individual or a collection of people.
Okay.
Wow. Interesting.
But again, that's my opinion. The storytelling is such a broad range that, you know, as you noted earlier, it covers many, many things, but...
Mm-hmm.
My passion and joy is just standing up in front of a group of people and spinning out a story, not memorized and not too prepared beforehand.
Does that take a lot of practice to come up with a story at random and just do it at the spot?
Well, if you're gonna come up with a story out of whole cloth and at random, yes, it does take some practice, but not maybe what the kind of practice you're thinking. It's not telling a story in front of a mirror 16 times. It's really becoming very, very familiar with the pieces of a traditional story so that you understand the structure and the form well enough to either follow it or play with it and break it. But generally, you know, if you walked into a group of friends and asked any one of 10 people, tell me the story of Little Red Riding Hood. If they grew up in a culture that knew about Little Red Riding Hood, you could probably get all 10 of them to tell you some version of Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah.
Some people might be more shy. Some people might be more able. Some people might not want to do it. But you would get some version of Little Red Riding Hood from each of them. So in some cases, it's safe to say that most of us could tell a story if it wasn't random, as you mentioned. If you're not making up a new story, you're following the bones of a traditional story, it becomes much easier to do that then and play with the story and the audience connection.
Okay. All right. Have you based any of some of the stories on something that happened in your life that you wish could have happened differently?
Oh, sure. Storytellers tend to not shy away from what most people would call terrible experiences, just because you, in your heart, you know that one day this...
Yeah. Kelvin? Okay.
Uh-oh.
Sorry.
Did I lose you?
Yeah, you kind of went out for a little bit. There's some hissing sound, so we lost maybe 3 seconds of what you just said.
Oh, okay. Yes, personal stories are something that a lot of storytellers like to do. And terrible events in your past are great fodder for good stories. Getting storytellers together or is just like getting a group of friends together, except storytellers love to revel in that terrible meal I had or the horrible experience trying to fly across the country because it makes great fodder. Good stories come out of terrible experiences. And that's not just personal stories. You look at all the traditional tales and the folk tales and how they're horrific things if you think about it, but they make a really good story.
Yes, they do. Not only that, even terrible things that happen in your personal life or my personal life, it seems to be more of like a grabber of attention. Like, yeah, I did the same thing too. Something like that, you know.
Well, oftentimes what you're looking for is at least some grain of common experience.
Yeah.
If you're laying something out that says, you know, I had this horrible, horrible thing happen to me. I went out for sushi the other night, and I tried something brand new, and I will never, ever try it again. I think most people could relate to some version of that. And if you can make that connection, then you have a relationship with the audience, and then you've got something to work out.
Okay. You were saying something, Andy?
Well, yeah, I was actually going to put you a little bit on the spot here. Kelvin and I, we go way back. We're actually very close friends. There was a story that you told me back when you were doing tournaments, and this wasn't a story that had necessarily been involved with your tournament use, but rather you had a fellow student who was female, and she had to spar this guy, and this guy was just not a fair player. Do you know which story I'm talking about?
I have no idea. Sorry, Andy.
He had so many stories told, he can't remember.
It was a female karate tournament pick, and this guy had totally, you know, broken the rules, but she had got him back out on the tournament floor. Does that ring any bells yet?
Is this the windmill story? Is this what you're talking about?
This is the one that ended in rip stud.
I still don't remember, Andy.
See, it was
such a great story.
I remember parts of it.
I don't know. Should I tell the story and remind you, and then you can take it over?
You know, you should tell the story.
There you
go, Andy.
I will tell the story.
So, basically, the story went like this, is that there was a fairly young female martial artist at a karate tournament, and she was fairly up and coming, and there was the big bad, the very big bad, you know, martial artist. I mean, you know, came from the dojo that probably, you know, spawned, "There is no mercy in this dojo, you will show your enemy no mercy." So they go off and they square off. And the guy just, you know, Hajime is called, they come in, and he just does an uncontrolled punch right to her torso and everything. And he had a penalty flag called on him, but it completely broke her poise. So there was like a minute timeout in terms of the tournament, where she had to go off and she had to meditate, and she focused, and she came up to her instructor and was like, "I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can carry on." And the instructor just looked her dead in the eye. He's like, "Just get him and get him good." So second bout happens. Okay. And again, the guy does just a completely uncontrolled roundhouse kick, nearly sweeps her leg. And, you know, she wants to call it quick. And everything, and again, another penalty is called, but, you know, this guy is playing psychological games, so, you know, and she goes to her sensei, I don't know what to do, you know, I'm trying to, you know, be legal about it, and it's just like, look, just, you know, keep your guard up, focus, and a way will be found. Third bout finally happens. This guy throws another uncontrolled kick, throws really high, he's trying to take her head off. She blocks. And then you hear, rip, thud. What had happened was, she had blocked, closed the distance, and ripped his cup off, tearing through his gi pants. Both officials looked at at the female student and said, "Print awarded."
See, you didn't need me at all.
But it sounded so much better when you tell the story.
Oh, that story. Oh, yeah, I know that story.
You know, he started out, I'm going, that sounds like Karate Kid.
Well, you know, I took some embellishments, honestly. I mean, I took additional storytelling class a while back, and I actually had referenced Christopher Volger. I'm probably completely mispronouncing his name, and he wrote this this book called The Hero's Journey. And he talks about how certain stories, certain myths follow a format. And it's primarily used by writers, but, you know, it's a situation where I kind of use this in my storytelling as well. I'm not much of a teller. In fact, I've never really told a story other than, you know, the bar stories that you hear and stuff. But I'll go over it real quick. You know, the heroes are introduced to the ordinary world. There's a call to adventure. The heroes are reluctant at first, or they outright refuse the call to adventure. And then they come across a mentor and are encouraged by it. And that's when they cross the first threshold into the adventure, where they encounter tests, allies, and enemies, and where they approach the innermost cave. They endure an ordeal, and then they take possession of their reward. They are pursued on the road back to the ordinary world, and then they cross over into the third threshold and experience a resurrection and are transformed, where they return to the regular world with the elixir or a boon or treasure to benefit the ordinary world. If you think about it, that's Star Wars. That's the entire trilogy right there.
And in fact, that's one of the major story formats for all sorts of stories. You know, any good Celtic story with a hero that sets off Tamlin and all of those are based off of a similar path of the hero's journey. And even fairy tales and folk tales tend to use a simplified version of that. An improv comedian named Keith Johnston actually set out and called the story spine, which is a great 8 steps to understanding basics of a storyline. And this tends to fit fairy tales and folk tales better than the epics or the larger heroes tales. But he said you have once upon a time and every day until one day. And then you have, and because of that, and because of that, and because of that, until finally, and ever since then. And those 8 pieces are essentially the same thing, where you leave the normal behind, when you go from the and every day and move into the until one day. And then you have a series of repercussions and a series of advancements of the story, and then there's some finalization of that, and then there is the wrap-up epilogue at the end. And if you look at almost any folktale or fairy tale, it follows along. And that's the structures that we were talking about earlier when you asked, was it difficult to create a story out of whole cloth? If you're familiar with the structures that create a story, a good story, then you can start filling things in. And even if they're rather random, they'll make a great story because they'll keep people occupied. Our brains are wired for these stories. So we're tuned in. We like to listen to them. We're understanding immediately that this is a string of events. So I think you did a great job with your story, or with my story, I guess.
Yeah, it was your story. I was, like I said, you told better. It's one of my favorite stories that you told, you know.
Well, I'm terribly embarrassed I don't remember it, although I could tell you the name of the person who was at the center of the story, but I don't remember telling you that story, but that's good.
I think it was a situation where we were just kind of, you know, we were literally chewing the bone at at Thanksgiving and, you know, just chewing the fat, and we somehow got in the pot on the subject of martial arts, and We were sharing all of our martial art experiences and and everything, and it was like I can't remember, but we just got on the topic of really good tournament experiences.
So then you end up with round after round of "so there I was" stories. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And everybody has to top the last story. Well, you think that's bad? That makes great storytelling.
So what kind of stories do you... I'll direct this question to both. I'll direct it first to our guest. Thank you very much for calling in. If you've just managed to log on, I'm talking here with Kelvin Saxton, who happens to be a member of the Bellingham Storytellers Guild. And we're talking about storytelling and how it's how it really is sort of a connectivity vector in our culture. So I'll direct this question first at you, Kelvin, and then Lynn, if you want to answer this question afterwards, that'd be great. But what kinds of stories do you enjoy?
As a listener or as a teller?
Why don't you go off as a listener?
As you can imagine, I also listen to a lot of stories. I have most of my friends are storytellers as well, some professional, some not. I really enjoy a couple different kinds of stories. One, I do like personal stories. And even though we talked about earlier about how, you know, terrible and tragic events make good fodder for stories, I actually really enjoy personal stories that are just about little glimpses into someone's life. When I was 10, this thing happened to me, and it was funny, hilarious, slightly frightening, life-changing, who knows. I like seeing those windows into people's life. I also like to listen to stories that have a sense of questioning to them, where they leave some space for me to think about the story even as it's being told. And some of the older folk tales are really good at that, where, especially if you have a good teller, and some of the tellers I've listened to are beautiful at this, they'll spin it out nice and slow, and you really completely get lost into the sense of wonder of the story. So I like good old folk tales that have that. And then every now and then, I just like a story that's just so funny that you can't breathe about halfway through. So I like all sorts of stories. It's not a very fair question for me to answer, really.
How about you, Lynn?
I guess I would be the same thing, too. I mean, recently I rewatched The Hunger Games on my computer last night, and so I like that story in which we have an unwillingness to be a tribute, and yet she had to volunteer herself because of the fact that her little sister has been called, and there's no way she was going to live through that. So, and she persisted and prevailed, and now I'm waiting for the second movie. But, you know, to kind of echo on Calvin's, I also like personal journeys because I'm going through my own, and I like to hear other people's personal journeys and how they prevailed. Coming out stories have been kind of something that I, not necessarily I want to hear from everybody, but I want to hear from certain people, especially around my circle of friends or new acquaintances and something like that, especially if, you know, to find out that they actually are still human and caring, loving, and instead of angry. And I want to know how they got there and, you know, what happened. Some people just become angry and you don't want to be around them. But there are certain number of folks that have gone through the bad stuff in their life, and yet they came out of it okay. I mean, there's probably some remnants of psychological stuff, but overall, if you just looked at them, you know, it's like, oh, you seem like a cool person I'd like to get to know. What's your story?
Right. And now you're getting down to, you know, probably one of the oldest purposes for storytelling there is, which is sharing common purpose, getting that sense of shared hope, survival, sometimes specific, you know, like here's a story to tell you how to go hunt antelope, but more often than not what you were talking about, which is, wow, you know, someone else went through a really rough patch and look where they are now. That's amazing. That's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I could probably do that too. Yeah.
Exactly. And,
interesting.
Yeah.
So, tell us, you know, I was curious, Calvin, how would you, you know, I mean, let's take a look at traditional storytelling, you know, from the past. I mean, it was used as a matter of social interaction. Storytelling was also a function of passing down tradition. Also, perhaps a function of public record and a form of teaching. How do you think technology has either downgraded or amplified the power of storytelling?
You know, that's been on my mind an awful lot because I'm trying to make the shift myself between just being an oral and traditional storyteller to getting some of my stories out in various other formats, either, you know, video of me telling live or laying stories over animation, audio only, video only. You know, I've been thinking about that a lot, and I'm not alone. A lot of the storytellers that I know and have talked to are looking at technology and realizing there's a whole new set of directions, not even just one, but a whole new set of directions where you can go take the same material and reach out and find a whole new audience that's vastly broad that you wouldn't have before. And I think there's a lot of people who've said, oh, you know, YouTube and the internet generation won't have anything to do with traditional storytelling. But I think the numbers that I've seen, at least in the North Pacific Northwest, make that a lie. We're seeing more and more new tellers come on, a lot of new tellers coming straight out of college who are very technologically savvy and ready to go, but who find something else that they need in standing live in front of an audience and delivering the story. And then, again, traditional tellers who've been practicing for 30 and 40 years who are now finding exciting new directions to go by putting new technology to use. And storytelling is on the rise, at least across America and other places in Europe and Asia that I'm aware of as well. So I think technology is actually giving things a boost rather than replacing or tamping down traditional storytelling.
I also think that technology is actually has made it more appealing, especially when it comes to like movie storytelling, you know, something that floats and then you see them float, like, ooh, graphics, you know, or something blowing up. Ooh, wow, this is great. You get all these cool techno pyrotechs doing all this stuff. Since storytelling is everywhere and you can't get away from it, would you say that writers in TV shows and movies and stuff like that considered also storytellers? As well as I know, actors tend to call themselves storytellers because they're actually being, you know, sort of live the life of their character in that moment in time as they're filming. Would you say they're also storytellers?
You've asked the question that every different group of storytellers will answer in a different way. On the one hand, as a traditional storyteller, I tend to, and I have to admit it, roll my eyes when Steven Spielberg has an interview and says, "Well, I consider myself primarily a storyteller," and I like to feel, you know, nice and superior and scoff and say, "You'd never survive standing up in front of an audience, you know, without." You know, $1 billion as a budget, you'd never make anything work. But, you know, it's easy for any group who are dealing with story to look at the other groups and scoff and go, ha, you're not real storytellers. But, you know, it's they're all different versions of storytelling. And, it really comes down to what we were talking about earlier, which is that human beings, our brains are wired to understand things in narrative form. We're used to having things presented to us in the this happened and then this happened and then I thought about it a little bit more and then this happened. That's what we want to make sense of the world. So really, television writers, movie producers and directors, actors, theater professional, improv, comics, people who are creating information that is fed to someone else in that style of a string of events and reflective moments to ponder those events, they're a storyteller. And I see some really wonderful things. And, you know, I can go fanboy on Joss Whedon. Now, I think Joss Whedon could stand up in front of an audience and probably kick it as a traditional storyteller.
Yeah,
but
I can see that.
But that's because I think he's really, really tuned into those underlying structures that we were talking about.
Yeah.
Including Joss Whedon, who else do you like to either listen to or perhaps even read?
Oh, let's see. As far as people who I think are really good storytellers, using the term to mean someone who has a really good handle of deep story structure, Neil Gaiman, Charles DeLint, Isaac Asimov, to push off into that line, Cory Doctorow, somebody like China Mielville, who messes with story structure, but I think he knows it well enough that he knows when he's screwing around with it, and that also works. Those are some of the writers. Jane Yolen, of course, but she's got a strong background in fairy tales and folk tales, which is not surprising that every time she stretches out into a new genre, it feels like good storytelling to me.
What's your earliest memory of storytelling?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Because when I fessed up to my family, my parents in particular, that I had become a professional storyteller and was actually getting people to fork over money to see me perform, they were quite bemused. They thought this was out of left field and had no idea that this was a real thing, actually. But that I find that hilarious because my earliest memories of storytelling are absolutely family reunion with my father's family. And, you know, every single adult in that case was telling a story. And family reunions for me, from my earliest memory, were a whole string of two or maybe even three generations of people spinning off long and fascinating stories. There's without a doubt in my mind, some of the best storytellers I've ever heard were people that I heard when I was just sitting on the floor or kicking around with my toys and listening to these stories about this relative who'd passed or that event or, you know, the blizzard with the bearskin rug and all, you know, these amazing stories. And yet, you know, nobody in my family considered themselves storytellers or even thought of that as a thing. That's just what you did when you got a dozen of my family together.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. I've never been a very good storyteller. I just thought when I was growing up, some of the stories I've made were made up, and I'm not much of a good liar, so I could never really come up with a good story. So it's always the truth.
Well,
darn it.
I think another, when you talk about lying or you know, let's be kinder and say completely fictional stories.
Exactly.
Of one form or another. I think another thread
embellishment.
That we should bring in here. Yeah, embellishment, yeah. I think another thread and really a training ground that we could bring in here is that there are a couple of generations now who have gone through role-playing games and even though they don't consider themselves storytellers, are absolutely fantastic storytellers in the sense of constructing stories out of whole cloth that are completely fictional but tight with good plot lines and characterizations and twists and climactic endings. You know, I grew up with D&D, and you know, my kids now grow up with other variations of role-playing games, and it's a great training tool for storytelling, as far as being able to just stand up and spin something off the top of your head. Not, I shouldn't say off the top of your head, because you have a goal and a purpose and an audience, mm-hmm. and a place that you want to get to. And playing role-playing games or LARPing, live-action role-playing games, is a fantastic way to build storytelling chops.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's actually also a secondary skill set that is, you know, if you find, you know, a really great, you know, this, and this is going back to role-playing games, whether it be tabletop or live-action, if you have a good storyteller or game master or dungeon master, do you think that type of storytelling, because it is a storytelling, it just happens to be interactive, do you believe that can develop a good skill set in problem solving, perhaps?
Oh, absolutely. And storytelling in itself is a useful tool in all sorts of problem solving, especially if you're dealing with the people as the problems, to be honest. if you need to convince a group of people to all move off in one direction, there isn't a better tool to do that than to come up with an appropriate story that hooks everybody's imagination in and gets them moving. And, you know, that's not really different than telling yourself, I just spent 80 hours putting together this game, and if everybody at this table doesn't head off east to the dungeon, there is no game to be had. So you have to spin a story that leads them down the merry path so that they get engaged into the story.
Man, that sounds like stuff.
Yes, I have to agree, Andy. That's exactly right, that there's a set of skills there. And really, you know, there's only a very few basic skills to storytelling in general. And one of them is being able to construct the story. That's half of the puzzle. The other half of the puzzle really is being able to deliver it, to use your voice as an instrument, to use your eyes to connect with people. And those are also skills that apply broadly in problem solving.
And there are times in which some storytelling is done in music. And I've heard, like, you know, on videos or parts of movies and TV shows in which the storytellers of the past had a lyra, as our lyra, that,
uh-huh.
and then they plucked
a lyre,
and
yeah.
A lyre, thank you.
Lyre or lyra, yeah, I think, depending on whether you're doing American or Latin.
They pluck and they use it as a little bit of a, like, a mood kind of thing, so that they know if the character is questioning, if they're happy, if they're sad, and so on and so forth. And I've also heard or read somewhere that the first, I guess, folks, or, you know, humans, I guess, that did as part of their storytelling to set the mood were the Aboriginals in Australia, because they would use anything, the clicks and, you know, all that stuff, and their musical instruments that they may have to set the mood and scare people and so on and so forth, their story. So I was like, wow, that's kind of cool. And of course,
well,
it's set in, like, the darkness with a campfire.
Sure. You know, that's still happening. If you look at the whole broad range, traditional storytellers like myself, a lot of us will carry an instrument with us, a drum or a flute or a ukulele or, you know, who knows what. It gives a good break in the story. Like you said, it sets the mood. Then there, you can push along that spectrum and find people who consider themselves primarily musicians who tend to have very good storylines and storytelling delivery in their songs. But then you think you were talking about lots of different various media as well. And if you think about movie or theater, music is very much a primary sense of place, context, emotion. All those things are really, you can get at them sometimes in 2 minutes of music, better than you could in, you know, 20 of telling a story with your voice and your words.
Yeah, music, yeah.
There's an old saying in the movie industry that 50% of your visuals is actually audio. It's kind of interesting, you know, coming from the visual storytelling, i.e. movies or animation, music, it's been my experience that music can really set the context for a scene, especially in terms, I mean, one of the biggest, I'm a big Star Wars fanboy, the middle three, New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, and Jedi, not the first three, although Revenge of the Sith was not bad. There are days with my geek group that we want to go out Jar Jar Binks hunting and, you know, punt a Jawa through Jar Jar Binks, but we won't go there. But John Williams, in my opinion, is a masterful storyteller, and he does it in such a way that you don't really need, well, his music really accentuates the entire experience, but if you just listen to the soundtracks, you know, without the context of the visuals, you still go on an emotional journey, especially, you know, with the opening theme, my personal theme, and interestingly enough, a lot of my my geek friends actually got married to, or the groom walked to the Imperial March from Star Wars.
Nice.
So, you know, it's very, I find that, especially as a musician myself, that music can take, you know, standard storytelling to an entirely new level. Is it absolutely necessary? No. But I think that, you know, music has been an important primal force in storytelling, especially in the days of yore that I've heard about, because my culture hasn't exactly been, man, I don't want to go into that. We're not going to open that can of worms. I'm going to back it up there. But I have heard that, you know, with a lot of the guitar storytelling, a lot of the drum storytelling especially, that it can add a certain edge to it, a certain accentuation. I remember participating way back in the day in my youth, quote unquote, participating in a couple of poetry circles, and I was absolutely surprised to see a set of congas in the corner, and that some people were telling stories to rhythm. And such.
Yeah, it doesn't take much. You can lay music under a whole story and do amazing things with it. And I have to admit that I admire people who can do that. Since I play flute primarily, it's really not possible to play flute and tell the story at the same time. But it doesn't take much, you know, in some cases just a minute or two of music, you know, to begin or end or take a break in the story to bring someone a skip ahead in the story, really, to put everybody's emotions and heart in the same place before you take off the next section. And I think if you listen to the music cues in movies and pay attention to the first, you know, 10 seconds of music that happens before things really get rolling on the screen, and John Williams is a really good example of this, that first 10 seconds sets everything up, and then the rest of it is just playing out underneath the visuals that go on and building or taking away. But in Star Wars in particular is a good example. If you see scene changes and let yourself really listen to the first little bit of music that William spins out, it's the same sort of thing that tellers are doing or that people are doing in coffee houses as musicians, is setting up that context for the story, for the string of events that's going to come next.
Excellent. All right, well, I don't want to say that we're running out of time, but so Calvin, thank you so much for calling in. You've enlightened us and you've given us a lot of information on telling and such. Before you go, could you tell us a little bit about the Bellingham Storytellers Guild?
Yeah, that would be great.
Sure, I'd love to do that. And if you guys want a story that's not a one that that I have forgotten to tell Andy years ago, I'd be willing to spin out a story too. But the Bellingham Storytellers Guild is one of a whole string of guilds in towns, both large and small, all across the United States. But I tend to think the Bellingham Storytellers Guild is pretty special because it's a relatively small metro area with a really big storytelling presence. We have about 30, 35 people on the rolls for the Storytellers Guild, and about a half a dozen of those are professional tellers. We have a monthly storytelling event, and there's usually at least one or two or sometimes three other events that individuals who are in the Storytellers Guild are sharing stories at and participating in. Many of the things we do are free. The professional tellers, of course, don't always perform for free, but sometimes we do as well. We often host regional events or help with storytelling festivals in Seattle, or during every other summer, there's a great storytelling festival out on Orcas Island that the Bellingham Storytellers Guild co-hosts with Ethnotech, which is the group out of San Francisco I mentioned earlier. The Bellingham Storytellers Guild also has hooks, believe it or not, into China and Mongolia. Because by dint of the way that Bellingham is built, there is a project called the New Wa Project, which is based out of San Francisco, that every other year brings a group of North American storytellers to a traditional storytelling village in China, about 200 miles south of Beijing, to exchange stories with the storytellers who live in the village of Gongsun. And we're making a documentary film along that line. And most of that work is based out of Bellingham, with sidelines in San Francisco and Chicago, believe it or not. Bellingham's a great place for storytelling. Not only the storytellers, but the town itself is a great audience. They fill up a hall for storytelling like other cities can't imagine.
Do you guys have like a center or an area or a place, location that you guys do the storytelling, or are you guys
We have our monthly free storytelling for the community happens in one of the libraries here in town, the Fairhaven Library, on the south side of Bellingham. But events happen all over. Bellingham has quite a few venues that are available, and we tend to spread things out. We might be in a dance studio for one event, and we have an adults-only Halloween story session that we do in October that's held in this great 120-year-old building downtown. Told at the museum, the City Hall, old City Hall Museum here last month. It tends to be scattered around. We do events in the summer that are outside down at Fairhaven Green and at various parks and out places in the county. So there's a lot of events going on, but we don't have a storyteller's hall or guild hall or anything along that line. Storytelling doesn't need a lot of space or extra equipment or tools, so we can meet in pretty much any coffee shop, restaurant.
Oh, wow.
Or a CD dive that we want to.
So how do you guys connect with each other as far as people getting a hold of storytellers? I mean, does the Bellingham Guild have a website?
We do. BellinghamStorytellersGuild.org. All one smushed up word. Bellingham Storytellers Guild.
BellinghamStorytellersGuild.com.
Dot org.
Oh, .org, sorry, .org.
Yep, .org, yes, please. So, yeah, so that it has our upcoming events on it as well. I have a website, kelvinsaxton.net, K-E-L-V-I-N-S as in Sam, A-X-T-O-N.net.
Okay.
Each of the storytellers has a guild. We in the guild has a website. We communicate through email. We hand out flyers. We advertise through the newspaper and the radio. So anything we can. Word of mouth still covers an awful lot.
Yeah. Stories that they tell about the storytellers.
Absolutely.
So, Kelvin, did I hear correctly that you wanted to tell us a short story?
Sure, I have a story to offer. If you guys have the time.
Oh, we have the time.
Well, I feel so bad that I let Andy down by, calling him a madman and not knowing the story.
I am a madman. What's your point?
I thought he was Panda.
I am the madman from time to time.
Okay, so here we go. This is a story that I learned from a storyteller named Eshu Bumpus, who's from the East Coast, but a fabulous storyteller. And it goes like this. A farmer was out in his field, clearing away the leaves of the old crop, when a snake came along. The snake said, "The others are after me. I think they're going to kill me. Hide me." And the farmer thought about it in a moment, and he opened up a basket at his feet, and he said, "Hide in here." And the snake did. Pretty soon, the other farmers came rushing up with their hoes and shovels and machetes and said, "Have you seen the snake?" And the farmer shrugged and said, "Did you try down by the river?" And off they went. The farmer opened up the basket and said to the snake, "It's safe now. They're gone. You can come out." The snake said, "Good. Now I can bite you." And the farmer said, "I saved your life. Why would you bite me?" And the snake said, "That's the way of the world, to repay kindness with cruelty." And the farmer said, "That's absurd." And they began to argue. And soon they had argued so much that a judgment needed to be called. So finally they agreed to go ask others. And they said, "Let's ask the tree." They came to the tree. The farmer explained, "I saved the snake's life, and now he wants to bite me. What should the snake do?" And the tree thought, and it thought, and finally it answered, "I give cool shade. I give branches to burn in the fires to cook with. And what do the humans do? Carve their names in my branches. Kick me, cover me with dust. You should bite the man." Well, now the farmer was worried. He said, "Let's go ask the river. This tree is crazy." So they went and asked the river. The farmer explained to the river, "I saved the snake's life, but now he insists he will bite me. What should the snake do?" And the river ran on and thought. And finally it said, "I give cool, clear water to drink. But what do humans do? Wash their clothes in me, throw their trash in me." And he said to the snake, "You should bite the man." Well, now the farmer was very worried, and as the wind blew across his hair, he cried out in desperation, "Let's ask the wind." And so they did. They explained the situation to the wind, and the wind blew and thought. And finally the wind said, "Everything acts according to its own nature, and we should be glad that everything acts according to its own nature." And he handed the man a drum, and he handed the snake a drum, and he said, "So let's be glad, let's celebrate, drum and dance, and be happy that everything acts according to its own nature." The wind turned to the snake and said, "Of course you must bite the man. It is in your nature to bite the man, so you must bite the man." Then the wind blew and said to the man, "But man, it is in your nature not to be bitten, so drop the drum and run." And that's the end of that.
I was about to say, oh, perfect for Earth Day.
Yeah.
There we go. It is Earth Day week. Well, Kelvin, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for gracing us with your stories and your experiences. Is there anything else you'd like to add to sign off and such?
No, except to say thank you for the opportunity, and I hope to talk to you guys again someday.
Oh, I hope so, too. You have a great voice, and have you ever thought about doing voiceovers?
Oh, yeah. Just another set of storytelling, right?
Yes, exactly.
Well, thanks, folks. You have a good night.
You, too. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you.
All right. That was great. I was, like, mesmerized just with his voice.
So, Rusty, if you're listening, you can call in now. Rusty, are you there?
No, she hasn't called in, or she has. I don't know. Here's the thing. That was more of the traditional storytelling in there, but we did kind of touch on the other kinds of stories, storytelling, which is like our personal stories and how we share our personal stories with each other in order for us to connect with each other. And for me, I use personal stories or my clients' personal stories to connect with other potential clients or current clients to see this is what this person had, this is what they did, and it either worked out or didn't work out.
Well, it's always interesting to hear the stories of motor vehicle accident survivors that, you know, when they come in and everything about, you know, how that motor accident happened. And
exactly.
It's a situation where it was like, you know, I kind of get a daily reminder working here with Century Massage that to really be thankful about healing and the people who facilitate healing as well, because there's just not a lot of that happening in this world because, you know, we've kind of gone from a community that supports each other to more or less a community that tries to profit off each other. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately,
it's
in our nature.
Yeah, right? Wait, you're trying to say we're all Ferengi? Oh my God, I am wearing my nerd today.
Oh, jeez. But yeah, that's basically, you know, just thinking about tonight's topic, I was like, wow, some of the reviews on Yelp is also more of a storyteller because they don't just say, I go to Century Massage because they're great. They say, why? You know, this is what happened. I was in a car accident. I went to this. Didn't work. Went to Century Massage, you know, after that first session, blah, 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 and Anna Marie did a great job, blah, 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 and I'll keep coming back, you know, kind of like that. And so it's kind of great that we get that storytelling thing everywhere. We're so used to seeing it that we don't necessarily see it anymore. You know what I'm saying?
Right. And I think storytelling has sort of morphed over the years.
Yeah.
I mean, especially with technology. It was, I remember I was in a class once over at the Art Institute of Seattle, and we were talking about media and technology and society and how the Gutenberg Press was a very controversial piece of technology. But account that.
What was that?
The Gutenberg Press was the first printing press developed, and one of the things that it printed out was a copy of the Bible. And
okay.
I'm reading a book right now. It's called Technopoly. Let me take a look real quick. I believe it's, don't go quote me this, but I believe it's Neil Postman who wrote the book Technopoly. And basically it says that this printing press took a lot of the power from the old church, on account that now you didn't have people necessarily gathering at church anymore, but rather they were reading the Bible for themselves in their own room. and interpreting the Bible that way. Now, here's a funny little bit of tip that I remember from my from that class over at the Art Institute. Do you know what paid for those Bibles, or at least you know the second book that was paid for? You know, or at least how were those Bibles paid for?
No.
The second book that was ever printed on that printing press, and this is from the lecture, was the fact that it was a book of erotica, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
So to quote my instructor, and we're kind of getting off a little bit off topic, but it's kind of interesting how technology affects our society. Because I'm a big fan on that subject, is that what drives new technologies is war, but what drives communication technologies is the sex industry. Believe it or not, we develop better technologies. We develop better technologies to tell some of the easiest stories ever, which is, you know, erotica. And, you know, it was like, what do you think back in the day when it was, you know, when the internet was going through these really archaic, ancient power lines called telephone lines way back in the day, and eventually things had to get faster and faster and faster. What people were going towards at that point was, you know, being able to watch video porn on the internet.
Oh, geez.
So, but, I mean, off that spinoff technology, I mean, there was a lot of good that came out of it, was the fact that now you can go practically anywhere right now and hear a story that you want to hear about, or you can learn about something that you want to learn about using YouTube, doing a Google or Bing search. You can find that information out there. Which I think is a wonderful
correct
thing.
But not all information that you find out there is true. And here's the thing that, I mean, I was like, bing, bing, bing. I mean, flags were going up in my head, like, oh, I need to talk about this later. I need to talk about that later. The storytelling things, when Calvin was talking, it can also be used to, as he said, sway people or to pull people back towards an end result that you want. And unfortunately, that's what we're seeing with the U.S. right now, as far as the Democrats and the GOP are concerned. I mean, some are saying these kind of stories. Like right now, what I've read somewhere online on an article was that now they're using the fact that the Boston bomber, the one who died, because of the fact that they came from a different country. I'm not quite sure exactly which country. Chechnya, I think.
Chechnya, okay. So for any listeners out there, it's Chechnya, not Czechoslovakia. Two very different countries.
Oh, thank you for that. Yeah, I know that. But But here's the thing with that one. There are stories now that the GOP is spinning that this is the reason why they need to kill the DREAM Act. Children.
Oh, wow.
Or pulled into the United States as a young child, or born here. Well, I guess if they're born here, they're national citizen. But when they're dragged or, you know, pulled to the States or something, or travel as a young kid and move to the States, that they should become citizens of the United States because it wasn't any of their choice to go with their parents. They have to go with their parents. And so they can actually fulfill the dreams, I guess, of being a United States citizen. I belong in that category. I was born in a different country, naturalized as a child in the United States. There are millions of people like that. And now they're going to use one incident to ruin the dreams of others. So that's basically the thing that I'm kind of not happy with right now. With that
You also kind of have to realize that there are members of the GOP, not all GOP members, but there are members of the GOP and probably members of the Democratic Party as well, who have no vested interest in having an educated populace, because an educated populace will be able to critically think. They won't necessarily be easily be swayed by emotion, because they'll think through things. So, you know, I believe this kind of comes down to, you know, making sure that our population is easily made to be subservient to whatever agenda, to those who are in power, regardless of whether they're GOP, whether they're Democrat, whether they're communist, whether they're socialist, whether they're a monarchical royalist. Essentially, one of the biggest threats to any, you know, tyrannical organization is education and the application of critical thinking. Now, where storytelling comes in with this, you know, to reference that, I believe that storytelling, you know, can be an avenue to increase critical thinking and critical awareness. That's why certain, you know, types, I think that's for the longest reason why the religious right has been so against the nerd gaming community, is because these types of gaming, you know, sets up certain real-life simulations, and you end up critically thinking about several things that may or may not go against proper Bible tradition. So
yeah, I can see that.
That's where I kind of think where the GOP is kind of coming from.
But it still drives me up the wall because of the fact that they're telling spinning stories that are, I mean, only true at one instant, and it's going to ruin it for everybody else. And
well,
they react emotionally rather than rationally.
Well, a big part of our existence is emotion. I mean, if you take away that emotion, that, you know, emotion is part of our judgment. You know, it's that weird gut feeling. Is there?
Yeah,
do you need a
balance? Shouldn't be used to set laws and policies that will affect other citizens, or you know, because of this small, you know, it. What I don't understand, really, is the fact that. Anyway, we're going off the subject of storytelling.
This is making a great story, come to think about it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's when Lynn actually lost it on the live show. No, it's just that there's
a
lot more
phone,
people,
I can run away.
There's a lot more people dying out there from other weapons, and then they are basically focusing on this at just, you know, I mean, lives are lives. When we lose lives, there are consequences, and a lot of people are affected by it. I mean, so we don't necessarily want to lose too many lives, and we want to make sure that we do something to prevent this, or at least minimize it. Unfortunately, they're focusing on the wrong thing to me as far as minimizing the deaths in this country. And I, you know, I don't necessarily want to have a go at it, how do you call it, argument with you, because it is the gun issue.
Well, I mean, wow, and we only have, what, 17 minutes to get into this? Speed debate, dun-dun-dun! You know, it's interesting because, you know, if we kind of want to stay on track here with the storytelling aspects, I mean, right now, you know, with the tragedies in with the Boston bombing, you know, I think at this point we're at a point in time right now where we need to help heal those lives. We need to help. We need to facilitate, you know, the mercy, the grace, and the healing, because that's what these people need right now. Now, the question, you know, which only begs the question to ask, you know, when do we have the discussion about the bombings, the shootings, and everything? And I've always been a proponent, you know, if we are going to be discussing you know, the bombs and the technology, you know, and the guns and the technology issue about it. Let's take a little, you know, let's take a page off from Sean Kennedy. What is technology? Technology is the manifestation of our will. So if we have developed such horrible technologies that have created bombs and guns, and that is a technology that is an expression of our will, where is our accountability for our will? Do you see where I'm coming from?
Yes.
At this point?
And no. Yes or no. They were, I mean, just like any story, somebody was being entertained by it. And then, of course, it's fiction or something like that. And then somebody takes it literally and then makes it happen. And then you look at them and goes, why did you do it? Oh, because I was bored. I mean, kind of like that. I mean, these weapons were made for something. And most likely it was it's to kill. These weapons were made to kill your next dinner, or to kill your enemy, or just to kill. And we're trying to, as a society, I'm hoping that we are trying to heal and change this culture into a killing. I don't like you, I'll just kill you because arguing with you is pointless. Rather than using words and stories to effectively change somebody's mind, or at least change them enough to say, oh, I'm sorry for doing this, or, you know, to become remorseful or something to that effect, we don't even use our words and stories to do anything, because the first thing that everybody comes to in mind is like either to hit, to take a gun out, a blade. I mean, come on. The parents from the Newtown folks have been telling their stories, and no one's really listening, and it's really sad.
Yes, and I'll admit, the closest I've ever been to gun violence, you know, has been, you know, reading about drive-by shootings in my hometown in Federal Way. In fact, it was my hometown, I believe it was last night or the night before, five people died because of gun violence.
Wow.
If we are to use storytelling as an effective deterrent against gun violence, and those stories have to be told, you know, that comes to a point. And I'm arguing from the point from, you know, why the NRA has been able to substantially win a lot of these, a lot of the hearts and minds of America.
Possible.
Is the fact that what it comes down to, what it comes down to is the fact that they've got the deep pocketbooks, they have the infrastructure. You know.
Here's the funny thing, though, okay? The NRA, when I've seen video clips of them, like, in the 80s, were saying exactly what we were looking for in the bill that didn't pass, which I don't understand how a bill didn't pass when we had the majority. I guess it's filibuster. Anyway. So they were saying the same thing, and now they're doing the opposite. What changed? Pocketbooks? Science?
You know, truth be told, I don't know. I mean, I honestly thought it was in the bag. I really thought the Democrats were going to be able to pass this piece of legislation. But apparently, you know, there were, I can't remember how many Democrats, but there were Democrats that voted against it. And I'm not entirely sure. And that was not the only bill that got killed that day,
that got shot down,
pun intended. Feinstein's.
Hey, no puns.
Feinstein's bill, Feinstein's assault weapons ban got shot down cold, you know, as well. So it was a very bizarre day, in my opinion, because you would have thought that the bombings and the shootings in Boston would have galvanized the nation, but perhaps there was something that that in our deep psyche, that for the predominant, you know, for these representatives, for these individuals to be like, maybe I want my populace to be able to defend themselves in the event of a Boston bombing. I think Massachusetts has got one of the most stringent gun laws ever. And where this guy was hidden, he was in suburbia. So, I mean, I'm just trying to imagine just how much more difficult this would have been if the guy had gone into like a middle America suburb where everybody's got a hunting rifle. I think that guy would have been shot.
You know
dead.
What? What's going to happen? It would have been a massacre all on its own because nobody knows the real story. And anybody who looked like him would have been gunned down because some are trigger happy. So, no, I do not want to live in a state or a city in that respect in which there is no law because everybody has a gun.
Right, which kind of, you know, I kind of follow up, you know, with that. And I'm quoting Neil Postman again from the book Technopoly, which is a really great book if you haven't read it yet, it's called Technopoly by Neil Postman, about how war technology, you know, for example, the samurai sword,
yep.
which is a piece of war technology, you know, only a certain class was allowed to have that sword. It was the warrior class. And if you were a member of that warrior class, you had to live by a certain code to be able to carry that sword. I think, you know, we here in America, we can possibly learn something, you know, from history about that, about what it really means to have, you know, responsible firearm usage and implementation.
Yeah.
I believe the left has demonized, you know, firearms and self-defense platforms to the point where instead of people going out and getting the proper training, they don't want to be shamed. They don't want to say, hey, you know, maybe I'm going to own a firearm and I should probably take classes. But if I take classes, I might get shamed, you know, by my other peers.
Crying,
you know? I mean,
there's a lot of
self-defense shaming going on. So I kind of want to put, you know, some of the irresponsible, you know, gun culture kind of facilitated by the left, because if they had encouraged proper gun safety from the begin with and not have, you know, self-defense shamed, you know, American culture, we would have a lot more responsible firearm users in the United States.
The left, you're saying, the shaming?
Yeah, there's a lot of self-defense shaming that comes from the liberal left. Now, I'm not saying that all liberals. I mean, heck, I'm a member on Facebook, Angry Gun Toting Liberal. Okay, my idea of a great day is to mail a picture of two gay men making out, open carrying, and I'll send that picture to every Republican because they would froth at the mouth because they're like, oh, we've got two gay men making out. I didn't need to see that. Oh my God, and they're armed. You know? So I mean, but when it comes down to it, and here's the other thing, and you know, I'm not a political analyst at all by any stretch of the imagination, but and this is my opinion. In America, we have them. You know, honestly, when it comes down to gay marriage, okay, women's rights, these are all rights of the individual. And I think there is something in the American subconscious that says the right to self-defense is a civil right. I have a right to defend myself with any means necessary, and it is on the same sacrosanct level than gay marriage, than a woman's right to choose, than an individual's right to say whatever they want, an individual's right to read whatever they want. And that's, you know, it was kind of funny because a lot of people were like, well, if gay marriage passes and if women's rights, you know, rights laws pass, we're going to lose our guns. And we're going to lose our right to self-defense. And it's like, no, you're not. These things actually edify the individual right. The rights of individuals.
I'm sorry that actually equate, you know? I mean, they were saying if marriage equality passes in the United States, it would and tidal waves, we're all gonna die, you know? Yeah, okay. And then they're gonna go on a divorce because gay marriage. I mean, these are the stories I'm hearing, you know? It's like, really? Really? How many?
Let me put you this way, okay? All right, I don't smoke pot, okay? I'm a heterosexual male who, you know, believes in the Second Amendment, all right? I honestly, you know, feel that, you know, a woman's right is a woman's right to choose. I'm a guy. I don't have, you know, when it comes to the woman's body, you know, that's her thing. Let her figure it out, okay? So, honestly, it just kind of, the entire, you know, gay marriage thing for me was like, I don't get it. I don't see how this is a lose situation for heterosexual men. Because, honestly, let's face it, you know, gay marriage is a great idea because at least now a lot of gay men are going to be comfortable getting married, so they will want to be with the person they want to be. They don't have to hide anymore. So all of the, you know, women who are pining after these gay men, they finally have the card to say, I'm sorry, I don't date chicks, and I want to be with this guy. So now they stop looking at the gay man, and now they might start looking at us heterosexual
men. Actually, the gay marriage thing was because of the fact that even with civil unions and even with putting together a living will or not living will, something like that, I guess a living will or a will or a durable attorney, power of attorney, is when one of the couple is in the hospital, the family can actually override those wills or power of attorney and not have that person be in there because they don't like him because they're gay. They don't want to accept. So this is the reason why the marriage equality actually was needed, because civil union wasn't enough. A lot of the, I mean, they were actually pulling their spouse out of the room. They couldn't be in there because the family of the person in the hospital were saying, "It's just, he's just a friend. It's only just family."
Wow.
That is the reason why. It has nothing to do with coming out or being out or staying out of the closet. You know, that was most of the reason why marriage equality needed to pass. So, yeah.
All I'm saying at this point is, like, if you're male and you like other guys, I'm going to encourage you on that path. I think you should be who you want to be. I think you should love who you should want to love. And to all the females who were kind of brokenhearted about finding out your the guy that you're crushing on is likes guys, trust me, there are plenty of heterosexual men who would like to buy you a dinner and possibly learn how to tango.
Well, here's the thing. They might not have a romantic relationship with their gay friends, but, you know, they have a friend for life.
Exactly.
Here's the thing that I read somewhere. And basically, this is why some people think there are homophobic guys. One, the fear that these gay guys are going to treat them like they treat their women, and that the women that they do have will be treated well by the lesbians. So that's why they hate gay people, because of, you know, they're going to lose a girlfriend.
Well, you really think, because a lot of my closest friends are lesbians.
Woohoo!
You know, it's great because I can go to the mall and with my lesbian friends, and
hey,
we go back and forth. Say, do you think she's hot?
Yes, that's another story for another time, okay? Which is, we're running out of time. So, thank you, folks, for joining us. We've had a great time tonight, and thank you, Kelvin, for calling in and sharing us one great story and your voice, by the way. It's awesome. And also, Andy, thank you very much for coming up with these cool questions for Calvin.
Oh, no problem. It's kind of what I do.
Oh, wonderful. And I wish you great luck with your radio, path. So until then, everybody, thank you very much. Join us again in 2 weeks, 8 o'clock Pacific daytime. It's a Pacific daylight time now. So thank you, and have a good night, folks.
Tonight, stay out of trouble, or at least don't get caught.
Yeah, don't get caught.
Thank you.